The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Between the Synapse with Mark Tobin. If you're looking to learn something useful, you've come to the wrong place. But as Belushi once said, it don't cost nothing. So let's get things started. Here's Mark Tobin.
All right, welcome to Between the Synapse. I'm your host, Mark Tobin. Thanks for listening in. Great show today. We're going to be talking about real-life American Soviet spies. Before we get started, however, I want to remind you to check out my blog at betweenthesynapse.com. And if you'd like, also check out previous podcasts of Between the Synapse radio show. You can also subscribe right there on the homepage so you can get notice of future shows as well. And you can also send in questions. If you want to ask any questions today, you can do so. Just call 866-472-5788. Or you can send a tweet at Between T Synapse. I'm very excited about today's show because it's about a television show which I've been following since its inception, I guess about 2 years ago, on a subject that I've been very interested in, and that show is The Americans, which is about a family, all-American family, which is living in Washington, D.C., outside Washington, D.C., actually. But they have an unusual characteristic in that they are actually Soviet spies. They were raised in the Soviet Union, and they were put together as husband and wife and embedded in the United States and have been spying on the United States for the Soviet Union for many years. They have two kids who were, at this point at least, unaware of what they do. And it's become a very interesting show, not only because of the spy aspect, but also covering the period of time, which it does, which is early in the Reagan administration. And the season 3 just started last night, and I saw it, and it was good as always. And in thinking about season 3, I wanted to take a look at, how accurate some of the portrayals of some of the storylines might be, but also dig a little deeper and perhaps learn about some of the real stories of Soviet spies, people, Americans who actually did spy for the Soviet Union. And in trying to determine who could help me do that, the person who first came to mind is one of the foremost experts on communism in America. Happens to also be a former professor of mine at Emory University, but that is Dr. Harvey Clare. Dr. Clare, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You've written many books, but in particular, you co-authored a book called Spies, The Rise and Fall of the KGB in America, which was published in 2009. First, let me ask you, do you watch the show?
I've watched occasional episodes. I don't watch it regularly.
So you know the gist of it?
Yes.
So let me just ask you this. First of all, how, generally speaking, you know, from your academic background, how accurate is it, both from a storyline as well as from just capturing the period?
Well, I think it's probably better at capturing the period than an accurate portrayal of Soviet espionage. The biggest problem, I mean, the couple are what is known in the intelligence trade as illegals. That is, Soviet spies came in two types, legal spies and illegals. Legal spies sounds a little bit like a misnomer, but what that means is that The Soviet Union would send Russians, Soviet citizens, to the United States to run their spy rings. And most of those people they sent here had official positions in the Soviet embassy or Soviet consulates. That is, you know, a guy might be a second secretary in charge of cultural affairs or whatever. And his real work would be running spies, supervising spies. And, of course, that's the way the United States operated in the Soviet Union as well.
Sure.
Some of the people that worked at our embassy in Moscow were working actually for the CIA. They didn't. That was not their official job title there, but that was what they were doing. The advantage of having a sort of legal agent is if he or she is arrested, they can claim diplomatic immunity, and they're simply deported. The disadvantage of having a sort of a legal agent is, in the case of Russians working in the United States, the FBI monitored all employees of the Soviet embassy and tried very hard to figure out which ones of them were actually working for the KGB. They would often follow people, Russians, when they left the embassy. And so if you were a KGB officer working at the embassy and you were wanted to meet one of your sources, every time you left the embassy, you would have to engage in a very complicated effort to shake off a tail. And
they portray that pretty well in the show, I think.
Right. The Soviets also employed illegal officers. And these were people that were in the United States under a false identity. Often they had they'd have an American passport or American documents that were forged. And they may have been smuggled into the United States. They may have entered with a false passport. The advantage of these kinds of people was the FBI had no idea who they were, which meant that they had much greater freedom to meet with spies and collect information. The disadvantage is that it's very, very dangerous. If you're arrested, you can't claim diplomatic immunity, and you can get thrown in prison for a very, very long time. And illegal officers, it took a lot of effort and expense to train these people. They had to be able to pass as Americans. So it was a very elaborate process, very difficult. And there were actually not that many of them. There were some, but they were dwarfed by the number of legal officers that the KGB had in the United States.
And were they really running Americans who were spying, or were they doing spying themselves?
They were running Americans, and that's one of the things where I think the show and reality collide a little bit. Some of the things I've seen suggest that this couple is very active in all kinds of shenanigans in the United States. The Russian illegals would not have done any of that. Their main task would have been to meet with spies and get material from them. They would not have been sort of operational in any other way.
Before we talk about the Americans who were spying and the scope of your research, you know, one of the things that I do think the show captures as well from the period purpose is the ratcheting up in the early 80s and the pressure that was being applied on, you know, whether it was the people in the Soviet embassy or whether it was the illegals to increase activity because, you know, of the Reagan administration.
Yeah, I think that the Russians, we know the Russians were petrified by Ronald Reagan. They're paranoid about him. They really were convinced that there was this secret American plan to launch a nuclear attack on the Soviet Union. we had no such plan, but and they put a great deal of pressure on their sources to try to develop information about that.
Did that lead to sloppiness on their part, from what you could tell?
To some extent, the Russians, sort of the history of Soviet espionage in the United States, the real golden age for the Soviets was the 1930s and the 1940s, and the periods after that, they were not nearly as successful. That's not to say that they didn't achieve some successes, and in the 70s and 80s, in regards to stealing military technology they and industrial technology, they were sometimes quite successful. But they did not enjoy the level of success that they'd had earlier. And one of the reasons for that was that in the 1930s and the 1940s, the vast majority of Americans who spied for the Soviet Union did so out of ideological devotion. They were communists or communist sympathizers. By the 1970s and 1980s, virtually all of the spies that the Soviets had recruited in the United States were mercenaries. They were doing it for money. And people that spy for money are often quite less reliable and much more difficult to handle.
So you're talking about like the latter 20 part of the century with Alder James and a Robert Hansen.
Right.
Who were both
right. Which is not to say, of course, that people like that were terribly destructive spies.
Right.
In terms of turning over to the Russians the names of the Russians who were spying for us, which got them killed. So those Ames and Hansen did a lot of damage. But they were mercenaries, they were more difficult to handle for the Russians.
Well, what? So let's start then, looking at the beginning. Then, how did the Soviet Union go about in terms of recruiting people who were sympathetic to the cause?
Well, they quite often, and particularly in the 1930s, the Soviets, you know, they had done some spying in the United States in the 1920s and after the Russian Revolution, but it really began to take off in the 1930s when they began to pay more attention to this country. And when the Communist Party of the United States began to grow, as a result of the Depression. As a result of the Depression, a number of middle-class people joined the Communist Party. The party became attractive to some educated people. And there was a huge influx beginning in 1933 into Washington, D.C. of young, idealistic New Dealers coming to staff the Roosevelt administration and its huge expansion of the federal government. And a certain number of those people that flocked to Washington and went to work for the government were either communists or sympathetic to communism.
We've got to take a quick break, and when we get back, we want to hear those people's stories. So stick around on Between the Synapse.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
Ah, a nice glass of wine is very refreshing after the end of a long day. But have you ever considered the story behind the wine? Tune in to Bacchus and Beery Wine Radio with your hosts, Roger and Donna Beery. You'll meet some of the people behind the world's wineries, travel the wine country, and learn more about that glass that you're enjoying. Roger and Donna will also give would-be vintners a behind-the-scenes look at starting a winery. Bacchus and Beery Wine Radio airs live every Friday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on Voice America Variety. What can you find on Get Real Radio? Well, quite honestly, who you really are. Join host James Robinson each week for a program designed to reveal more about yourself and your world through words of wisdom and profound guests. You'll discover more about the spiritual movement and how it can work with you and alert you to problems you may not be aware of. It will educate, titillate, and enlighten your mind. Get Real Radio is broadcast live every Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. This could end up being the best time of your week.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You are listening to Between the Synapse with your host, Mark Tobin. If you want in on this week's discussion, please call us at 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to mbt@betweenthesynapse.com or on Twitter at Between T Synapse. Now, back to the show.
All right, welcome back to Between the Synapse. Today we're talking about the real American spies with the premiere of season 3 of The Americans. We're talking to Harvey Clare of Emory University, teaches political theory and 20th century political ideologies as the Andrew W. Mellon Professor of Politics and History. He's also the author of The Rise and Fall of the KGB in America. And he was also nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for his work on the heyday of American communism, the Depression Decade. Speaking of the Depression Decade, that's where we left off before the break. And Dr. Clare, you were talking about the influx of communist sympathizers into Washington and how that impacted the opportunity for people to spy on the Soviet Union.
Right. You got in the early 1930s among the New Dealers. There were a relatively small number, but still a significant number of people that were attracted to communism, and they began meeting. And several of these groups originally they were sort of communist discussion groups. People would gather, government employees would gather, and they would talk about communism. They collect party dues and so on. A couple of them soon morphed into spy networks, and one of them was led by a man named Whitaker Chambers, and it included a young State Department employee named Alger Hiss, and Chambers would gather material from Hiss and from several other government employees, and he would then transmit it to his superiors. Chambers himself worked for what was known as GRU, which was Soviet military intelligence. And there were several groups like that in Washington, and they included some people in significant positions. Hiss was a rising young star in the State Department. There was another State Department employee, a guy named Larry Duggan, who was the Assistant Secretary of State for, in essence, it was a different title in those days, Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs. There was several people in the Treasury Department, including a guy named Harry Dexter White, who eventually rose to Undersecretary of the Treasury. So there were a number of people in positions to provide important information, and they did. And
what? Give me a couple examples of what types of information were being passed.
Well, Harry Dexter White and the people in the Treasury Department were providing information about American negotiations with European countries over trade, over monetary affairs. Hiss was providing, and Duggan were providing whatever information on diplomatic negotiations came across their desks. Reports from ambassadors about their dealings with foreign leaders. Some of it was innocuous, some of it was significant.
And what about the counter-espionage efforts at this time?
Pretty pathetic. There was very relatively little. The United States was really quite ill-equipped to do counter-espionage. And very little of it was done. It was pathetic. And that really continued into World War II. It was not until World War II that we really began to emphasize counterintelligence. And even then, most of it was directed at German and Japanese and Italian counterespionage, not Soviet.
And was it out of ignorance? Was it out of lack of capacity? What do you attribute that to?
I think both. I think there was a kind of sense that disbelief that this would occur. Budgets were low. The FBI, J. Edgar Hoover was far more focused in the 1930s on crime, Dillinger and
sure.
Pretty Boy Floyd and all that sort of stuff. Counter-espionage was just not a very high priority, and we paid a very significant price for that in later years.
And then, what about? First of all, share. Do you have a couple sort of favorite kind of antidotes?
The one that strikes me as the most incredible is, of course, a lot of the information exposing communism in the United States came out of the House Committee on Un-American Activities, UAC. Which in the 1940s, in particular, developed this reputation as a bunch of crazed right wing lunatics. People may not recall or know that UAC had its beginnings in the 1930s when it was known as the Special Committee on Un-American Activities, and it first got set up. I think it was 1934. It might be 1936, when the House of Representatives passed a resolution to set up a special committee to investigate un-American propaganda. And the real impetus behind it was the activities of the German-American Bund in the United States. The Bund was a pro-Nazi organization that was financed by Hitler and Nazi Germany. And they were producing a lot of propaganda, and they were holding big rallies in places like New York. And there was a great deal of concern. And a congressman from New York, a guy named Samuel Dickstein, who represented a heavily Jewish district on the Lower East Side, proposed this resolution to set up a special committee to investigate this sort of stuff. Normally, when a special committee is set up, the person that offered the sponsoring resolution becomes the chair. And Dickstein expected that he would become chair of the committee. He didn't, for some very complicated reasons. And the chair of the committee was a guy from Texas named Martin Dyes, D-I-E-S. And under Dyes, the committee did investigate the Nazis and fascist groups, but it spent most of its time investigating communism, and that was sort of the origins of the UAC's evolution into an anti-communist committee. After World War II, it became a permanent committee of the House of Representatives. The great irony is that Samuel Dickstein was a KGB agent.
Really?
He was a Soviet spy. And we learned that when Russian archives were opened in the 1990s. Dickstein was not a communist by any stretch of the imagination. The cover name that the KGB gave him was Crook, and they just paid him off. He took money. And the Russians, the Soviets, wanted this committee because they thought that it would investigate, among other, it would investigate fascists, but it would also investigate white Russian organizations in the United States. These were groups that related to the Tsarist aristocracy and fiercely anti-communist, and the Soviet Union was paranoid about them and wanted to use this committee to investigate them and get information about them. So the great irony is that the House Committee on Un-American Activity owed its creation to a KGB agent.
I did not know that. That's rich.
Yeah, and Dickstein, he eventually retired from the House and he became a judge in New York. So
it wasn't until the 90s that was discovered that he was responsible.
That's correct. Yeah.
Wow. Well, tell me about that. I know in the book there's a story about I think it's Martha Dodd.
Yes.
Liza.
Martha Dodd Stern. Her father, William Dodd, was a professor at the University of Chicago, who Franklin Roosevelt appointed as ambassador to Nazi Germany. William Dodd was a liberal and very gentle, humane man. And FDR appointed him. He had recently been widowed, and so his daughter Martha went with him to Germany, to Berlin, where she served as sort of his hostess at the embassy. And Martha was, as they say, a piece of work. She embarked on a series of affairs in Berlin. She slept with some leading Nazis, and she also slept with an official from the Soviet embassy who recruited her as a KGB agent. And she provided the KGB with material from her father's office. She cut a wide swath through Berlin. It's a fascinating story because her lover, whom she hoped to marry, the Russian lover whom she hoped to marry, he was recalled to the Soviet Union and thrown into the gulag. And
for what reason?
They just suspected him of being a Trotskyite, or they didn't really need a reason. And
of course,
the KGB had him continue his correspondence with her from prison because they wanted to keep her, you know, under control. She came back to the United States and. She continued to work for the KGB. There's in the Russian documents that KGB documents that I read, that there's this incredible account of a meeting that a courier for the KGB has with her in Manhattan, where she meets with him and she goes on and on about all the people that she has slept with, and this guy is sort of shocked, and he tries to lecture her about communist morality, and and she looks at him, and you know, and then she comes on to him, and he writes this shocked report to his superiors saying that he tried to set her straight, but you know, she's really quite decadent,
And then he was sent to the gulag.
She married a man named Alfred Stern, who was whose first wife had been an heir to the Sears Roebuck fortune, and so Mr. Stern was quite wealthy, and so they were, you know, these two millionaires, both of them working for the KGB, until the late 1940s, when they were about to be indicted as Soviet spies, and they fled first to Mexico. and then to Czechoslovakia, where both she and her husband lived out their lives. They died in communist Czechoslovakia.
And, you know, her motivation, was it for kicks, do you think, or was she truly sympathetic to the cause?
I think both. You know, she from the accounts, she clearly believed in communism. It was also, I guess, sort of somewhat of a lark. She enjoyed, even in Czechoslovakia, you know, living in exile, she and her husband lived quite well. So it's not like they were willing to sacrifice all their riches for the proletariat.
Yeah, of course, of course. Well, so we've got to take a break. When we get back, I'd like to learn more about the background for the book, and particularly about your research and through the archives. So stick around. We'll be back on Between Synapses.
Stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
How do you achieve the utmost success in your life, career, faith, relationships, and more? It's all here in The Business of Living with host Scott Ventrella. Scott has experience as an executive coach, sought-after speaker, and lecturer. He and his guests will offer practical solutions and strategies to help you move to the next level of success, no matter where you are in your life and career. The Business of Living airs live every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
American Heroes Network is a program for and about our American veteran heroes and their families. Join host Gary Ray as he shows what is being done to help our veterans and showcase the companies and organizations that are helping our veterans and their families rebuild their lives. Listen for American Heroes Network, live and powered by the Voice America Variety Channel, every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time.
Women can live their lives to the fullest and realize their dreams for growth and greatness. Georgine Summers knows. As host of On the Edge, Georgine will give you powerful tools and rules to help you change direction in your life and get rid of the fears that stop you from living your dreams. Stretch your boundaries and become the amazing person you've always wanted to be. On the Edge with Georgine Summers airs live every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
You are listening to Between the Synapse with your host, Mark Tobin. If you want in on this week's discussion, please call us at 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to mvt@betweenthesynapse.com or on Twitter at @BetweenTSynapse. Now, back to the show.
All right. Welcome back to Between the Synapse. We are talking about real American spies, the truth behind The Americans, which premiered season 3 last night, if you had a chance to watch it. And we're talking to Harvey Clare of Emory University. He is the co-author of The Rise and Fall of the KGB in America. Tell me about the background of not just this book, but you also had some previous books as well that were based on research through the Soviet archives, which I guess were released, sometime in the mid-90s.
Yeah. Well, I went to Russia, the former Soviet Union, in 1991, shortly after the failed coup against Mikhail Gorbachev. And I'd actually been planning the trip before the coup. I was going to do some research in an archive. I got there, it was after the coup, and the particular archive that I was going to work in was not terribly helpful. But the Boris Yeltsin, after crushing the coup, had outlawed the Communist Party, and he had seized their property. And among the property that he had seized was the Communist Party archives. And he opened the archives, in part because he wanted to discredit the Communist Party, and he'd been a high-ranking communist. He knew there was going to be a lot in the archives that would discredit them. And so I went to that archive. It had just been opened. I was the first American and one of the first Westerners allowed in. And I started going through some of their American communist material, because that's what I had written about in the previous couple of decades, the American Communist
and
Party.
Just hold on. I mean, tell me, like, emotionally, I mean, this has been basically, you know, your life's work. What was it like for you to have that opportunity?
I tell you the truth, it was a little bit of fear. I'd been writing about American communism for 20 years and based on material that was available in the United States. And, you know, I made some very confident pronouncements and been involved in all kinds of disputes with other scholars. And now I was going to look in these archives. What if I was going to find stuff to indicate that my interpretation had been totally wrong? I was, you know, just write a book or write an article saying, I screwed up, sorry, I'm finished. But, you know, fortunately, I didn't. But among the things I began to come across as I went through the archives, and I was the first person to go through a lot of this, to look at a lot of this stuff, were some messages that were stamped top secret. And they were from Georgi Dimitrov, or a guy named Georgi Dimitrov, who had been the head of the Communist International, which supervised communist parties around the world. And they were either to or from a guy named Fitin, who I had no idea who Fitin was. And they asked for information about Americans. And there were a couple things that were quite striking about these things. First, they were stamped top secret. And, I mean, I'm no fool. My mama didn't raise a fool. Anything that's stamped top secret, I probably want. But I recognized a lot of the names. And they were names of people that had been accused by Elizabeth Bentley and Whitaker Chambers, both self-confessed Soviet spies in the late 1940s, names of people that they said had been spies. And, you know, on the one hand, you might say, well, okay, perhaps these are reports going to Moscow explaining what Bentley and Chambers said, the names of the people they accused. Except the dates on the letters were from 1940, 1941, 1942, which was before Bentley or Chambers had gone to the FBI or their information had been made public. And then I found out who Fitin was. He was General Pavel Fitin. He was the head of the KGB's Foreign Intelligence Department. So it was clear that these were sort of vetting letters. The KGB was trying to get information on people that it was recruiting to spy, Americans that it was recruiting to spy. Well, naturally, I marked all this material to have copies made. In those days, 1991, 1992, my first trips to Moscow, there were no Xerox machines in the archives. So if you wanted copies of something, you had to mark them, and then when you left the archive, they gave you microfilm of the documents that you had asked for. Mm-hmm. So when I left Moscow after that first trip, I had a thick roll of microfilm filled with documents labeled top secret, which made me a little bit nervous going through customs. But as a result of those documents, my co-author John Haynes and I wrote a couple books, the first one called The Secret World of American Communism, which exposed the role of espionage and the complicity of the Communist Party of the United States in espionage for the Soviet Union. That led to a series of books. Shortly after that, the National Security Agency and the CIA released the so-called Venona documents, which were, this was a project started during World War II, where the the forerunner to the National Security Agency, tried to decrypt Soviet communications. During the war, all international cable traffic had to be turned over to censors. So the government collected all international cable traffic, including hundreds of thousands of messages between the Soviet embassy in Washington and consulates in New York and San Francisco and Moscow. And it was all enciphered and encrypted. And they began this massive project called the Venona Project to decrypt this material, and they eventually decrypted parts of it. And this also exposed large numbers of Soviet spies. And so John Haynes and I wrote a book on Venona. And then a few years after that, we got in touch with a former KGB officer named Alexander Vasilyev, who was living in Britain. He still actually lives in Britain. He's become a British citizen. He had been recruited by, he'd been in the KGB and he quit around the time of...
Can you do that?
The failed coup against Gorbachev. And he had been recruited to write a book on Soviet espionage in the United States, and he was given access to KGB files. And he made extensive notes, often copying documents verbatim. And he ran into problems with the KGB people. He became afraid for his own life and eventually fled the Soviet Union. But he was afraid to take the notebooks that he had written all this stuff in with him, that he was afraid they'd be confiscated. So he left them with a trusted friend. And then several years later, he had the person ship the notebooks to him in England by, I think, DHL or something like that. And so we wound up writing Spies, The Rise and Fall of the KGB in America, from his notebooks. And
wow.
So they're based on the actual KGB documents that he saw.
And those documents are not
available.
Would not
now
be public. Yeah.
The Venona documents are available online. If you go to the National Security Agency website, you can read all the Venona documents. Actually, Alexander Vasilyev's notebooks are also available online at the Woodrow Wilson Center website, but the actual documents themselves are closed in Moscow.
Right, right. So let me ask you, when you know, you talk about people, you know, spying, American spying for the Soviet Union in terms of numbers. You know, you talked about the Committee on Un-American Activities, you know, particularly in the 50s, where it got out of hand and got crazy and everybody was accused. What is the volume, what is the number that you believe accurately reflects how many Americans actually spied on behalf of the Soviet Union?
We tried to calculate that for the 1930s and 1940s, and our estimate is approximately 500.
And I think most people would think that probably the number would be much greater based upon lore.
Yeah. No, 500, as best we can tell. There may be some that we're not aware of, but that's still a considerable number. Remember, this is particularly, most of these people are in the 1940s, at a time when the United States and the Soviet Union are allies. Now, the number that they recruited to spy once the Cold War began, we don't have, I don't think anybody's got a real good feel for that. My guess is that about that same number. It's not a mass production industry.
Right, right. I want to ask you about some particular names, but we got to take one more break, and then we'll be back up between the synapses.
Streaming live. the leader in Internet talk radio. VoiceAmerica.com.
Museums are great places to work and wonderful places to visit. But are they essential? How can we improve our museum practice so that museums remain vital and essential players in society? Listen for Museum Life with host Carol Bossert, where each week we'll discuss timely and topical issues of concern to the museum community. Museum Life can be heard live every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Join Dr. Linda Iniguez every week for the Shrink Wrap Forum. This show discusses topics that you wouldn't normally hear in today's media. In the forum, virtually no topic is off limits. We invite you to join us and participate or dive into the stream where we value independent thought, talk to those people that are making a difference, and explore ideas considered outside the box. The Shrink Wrap Forum can be heard live every Monday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
In the spirit of Have Couch, Will Travel, Dr. Carol Lieberman creates a haven of sanity in an increasingly insane world. Each day we are bombarded with news of events that have never crossed our wildest nightmares. Society is spiraling out of control and everyone is reeling from it. But now there's an answer. The best way to keep sane in this insane world is to tune in to Dr. Carol's Couch on Voice America. Dr. Carol, a certified media psychiatrist, will broadcast live from her Beverly Hills office every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Call or log in and get help with whatever is sending you reeling, whenever you need a soothing voice to calm and advise you. That's Dr. Carol's Couch every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time here on America's Voice, voiceamerica.com.
Stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You are listening to Between the Synapse with your host, Mark Tobin. If you want in on this week's discussion, please call us at 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to mbt@betweenthesynapse.com or on Twitter at BetweenTSynapse. Now, back to the show.
All right, we are back on Between the Synapse talking to Dr. Harvey Clare of Emory University about real Americans who spied for the Soviet Union. Let me just ask you about a few names that were mentioned as people who might have spied for the Soviet Union at one point or another. Ernest Hemingway. Spy, not a spy.
The KGB documents indicate that they approached Hemingway. KGB approached Hemingway, and he agreed to work with them. And then he never did anything.
He was too busy drinking, right?
Quite possibly. They would meet with him and say, yeah, he's really enthusiastic about working with us. He really wants to work with us, but then he doesn't do anything. He was certainly willing to cooperate, but there's no indication that he ever did.
J. Robert Oppenheimer.
Oppenheimer, of course, was the man that ran Los Alamos and developed America's atomic bomb. The Soviets were exceedingly anxious to recruit him. They knew that he was a secret member of the Communist Party, something that Oppenheimer denied to his dying day, but he was lying. He was a secret member of the party.
And by the way, how do we know that now?
Again, these KGB documents refer to the fact that he was, and that's why they thought they could recruit him. The material has come out in various places. A couple of biographies of Oppenheimer have turned up evidence that he did secretly join the party. And I think that's what got him into so much trouble, because he lied about that to security people, and that led him into kind of a web of lies that really wound up losing him his security clearance. The interesting thing from the KGB files, they tried very hard to recruit him, but they failed. Mm-hmm. They could never get in touch with him. When he took over direction of Los Alamos, he was encased in pretty tight security. And there's no indication. In fact, that there's positive indication that they failed to recruit him. The KGB officer in charge of the San Francisco office was recalled to Moscow in 1945. And when he got back to Moscow, he wrote a report on his activities. And he was, the reason he was recalled was for poor performance. And he wrote a report, which is in the Vasiliev material. And he said, you know, I tried very hard to meet with Oppenheimer, but I could never do it. And we never were able to recruit him. So they tried, but they failed.
Klaus Fuchs.
Klaus Fuchs was a German-born physicist who worked on the British atomic project and was brought over to Los Alamos with a contingent of British scientists. Fuchs had agreed to work as a KGB spy while he was still in Britain, and he turned over absolutely vital information from Los Alamos.
Such as? Any idea?
Well, he turned over information about implosion, which was the new technique that was developed at Los Alamos to set off an atomic weapon.
And so, I mean, I suppose that was one of the reasons why the Soviets were able to develop the weapon so soon after.
Yes, I mean, we now know. I mean, Fuchs, of course, we knew that he had been a spy because the British arrested him. On the basis of the Venona decryptions, which revealed that what he had done, although that was never mentioned in court, and Fuchs confessed and served 8 or 9 years in prison, then went to East Germany. One thing that was not known until the Venona material became public in 1995 was that there was another physicist, an American physicist, at Los Alamos. Of course, we knew about another American at Los Alamos, David Greenglass, who was Ethel Rosenberg's brother, Julius Rosenberg's brother-in-law. He was a machinist, and he confessed, and he implicated Julius and Ethel Rosenberg as having recruited him to provide information from Los Alamos. But the Venona material revealed that a young physicist named Ted Hall had also been a Soviet spy. Hall was a prodigy. He'd graduated from Harvard at 18 or 19 in 1943 and had been immediately recruited to Los Alamos. He was the youngest physicist there. And he was a communist, and he determined to turn information over to the Soviets. And on his first leave back in New York, he and his college roommate tramped around New York City looking for a Soviet agent, and they eventually found one. And Hall turned over absolutely vital material. When the Venona material was being worked on, a decryption revealed what Hall had done, and the FBI tracked him. He was no longer at Los Alamos. He was getting his PhD at the University of Chicago, where he shared an office with Edward Teller, who was working on the H-bomb. They brought him in. They brought Hall in for questioning. They could never break him, and the government was unwilling to use the Venona material in court, so they could never prove a case against him. And so Hall got away with espionage, and he turned over really vital information. The first Soviet atomic bomb was a copy of the American bomb.
Nice. Very nice. Listen, we've got just a couple minutes left. What lessons, you know, if you're advising the U.S. government, you know, certainly I'm sure Russia right now, the other big threat, you know, is coming from various terrorist groups, be it Al-Qaeda, ISIS, who are also trying to infiltrate the U.S. in various ways. You're advising the national security apparatus. What lessons learned?
Well, one lesson is that in one sense, ideological spies were easier to detect than people spying for other motives. With these spies from the 30s and 40s, once the government instituted a loyalty security program, Harry Truman instituted one in 1947, and within a relatively short period of time, most of the spies were weeded out of the government. Now, the loyalty security program came in for lots of criticism because what they did was they went after people who had any record of communism in their background.
And Dr. Claire, I probably shouldn't have gotten into that so late in the show because we're out of time, so we'll probably have to do the lessons learned another time.
Okay.
I want to thank you so much for joining. Really, really interesting stuff. Thanks for listening to Between the Synapse. Check out BetweenTheSynapse.com for the podcast for this or other shows. I want to thank the team at Voice America. Take care. Thanks for listening. Join me next week on Between the Synapse.
Thanks again for joining us this week. Mark Tobin and Between the Synapse will transmit once again next Thursday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. And remember, you never know what lies between the synapse.